fantastic that you all are here, actually, because since it's all tear down moment, and still we have lots of people here. Interesting. This is as well an interesting talk, because it's Helen Lee who's going to present us, actually give us an overview, actually, about what hackers, you know, in music meant, actually, in the history. So it's a given overview. I understood as well she gives certain examples, and I think she's going to kick this a little bit further, because she's going to talk a little bit about her current work and future objectives. So I would, fasten seatbelts, I would say. Here she is, Helen Lee. Give her a warm applause.
Hello. So I'm Helen. This is, if you want to follow my stuff or download any of my things that I mentioned in the talk, I've got GitHub and various, I put lots of my work on Twitter, so there we go. Okay, right. I am going to talk to you today about, we're going to give you a story. I'm going to give you a story about how a group of music hackers in the 1940s changed the face of music technology forever. And how they didn't know anything about what they were doing, but they still managed to do some incredibly cool things by just disregarding and being really awesome hardware hackers. I'm also going to give you an overview of some of the coolest projects coming out of London and Berlin at the moment. I'm living in Berlin at the moment, but I was active in the music hacking scene in London for a long time as well. So I'm going to show you some cool projects. But before I start off on my story and core projects, I'm going to just introduce myself. I am a creative technologist, which is a ridiculous buzzword, but people like to put you in a box. But I'm basically a massive nerd who really likes arty stuff, so I like to smush them together. My favorite things to smush together are electronics and hardware with music technologies. So with that in mind, I make a lot of strange musical instrument creations, usually very experimental in form. I'll show you some of that as well. This is one of my experimental instruments. I make sonic circuit sculpture creatures, and I've taken them on residencies in London, Shenzhen, and Copenhagen. I just really like experimenting with what a musical instrument looks like. Not so much what it sounds like. I mean, I am into other people's noise art, but for me, I like my instruments to sound melodic. Form I'm very interested in experimenting with. I also really like, at the moment, this is made out of brass, and I've made a lot of stuff with different metals, but at the moment I'm on a big soft circuit kick, so I'm experimenting with electronic embroidery and soft robotics to make kind of kinetic, sculptural, squishy creature things, and I'll show you some of that later too. Obviously, this doesn't pay my rent, shockingly. So I also do some product design and a lot of curriculum-based things. I'm a writer as well. So this is a product that I designed. That's actually my hand on the box. Very exciting. And it's a wearable instrument for children, sold by P. Marini and Adafruit and, you know, etc. And it's a DIY wearable gesture-based instrument for children to learn how to code with. And I designed that with Imogen Heap. And I'll tell you about that cool project later, but that's something I do. And I also do a lot of writing. This is a still from one of my books. I wrote recently, last year, it came out, one called The Crafty Kid's Guide to DIY Electronics, where I teach basic electronics through the medium of papercraft, origami, sewing, and kind of like DIY robotics as well. I also write for Hackaday. I've written for blah, 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 it doesn't matter. I write words for many sometimes. Anyway, that's me. I am going to tell you one of my favorite stories of music tech history. I'm going to start off here with this rather pretentious quote from a rather pretentious man who I still kind of love. It's a guy called John Cage, who most people know him for his experimental compositions and his many and varied writings on the subject of what is sound and what sound art is. But he was also pretty early on a hardware hacker. He made experimental instruments. Actually, one of his first famous pieces was him like smashing up a piano and changing that. So he was a composer, but he was also an experimental hardware artist. And he said this: there is no noise, there is only sound. And the reason I put this quote up there is to kind of remind you that all music is made up, okay? All instruments are inventions. The violin wasn't a violin until probably the 13th century, when various instruments that came before it converged, and someone using new techniques, new tools, and it starts and it keeps evolving through the ages, right? And I think you could think of an instrument as a specific thing, but it's really not. We've been messing around with sound since we've been humans, basically. And ditto with compositions. You might think of classical music mainstays like Stravinsky, Strauss, or Debussy as these kind of like boring establishment figures. But actually, in their day, they were seen as avant-garde. People walked out of their performances. There were hit pieces about them in the mails, you know, the Daily Mail of the time. So basically, anything that sounds strange to you now, or something that's experimental to us, could well have an influence in a long-reaching way. Yes, here we are. Oh, I'm going to tell you about my favorite conspiracy theory as well. So even down to the note A, 440 hertz, middle A, it was not 440 hertz until the 1950s, when a group of dudes met up in one room in London, and everybody signed this agreement saying, okay, now an A is a 440 hertz. Before that, a flute in Italy might sound different to a flute in France. You'd have like these small tonal variations. So it wasn't until, the 1950s that it became actually the letter A. There's a wonderful series of conspiracy theories around this that they chose 440 hertz because it's a method of population mind control. And there are alternative websites out there now. You can literally go, and if you search for like 440 hertz conspiracies, there are websites that are campaigning, like groups that are campaigning for it to be changed. For the whole of modern music to be changed. There's one at 432. There's one at 438. And if you're in the 438 camp, because there are opposing camps as well. So if you're in the 438 camp, you're in luck because someone's made a music adjuster. Okay, so you can take your track that you've done and you can put it into a converter and it will convert all of your music into 438. So you can do that if you like. And there's even a radical fringe group calling for the middle A to be 538, which is absolutely insane. But there we are. I love it. So if you ever want to go down a conspiracy theory YouTube black hole, which you probably will do, we're all at camp. Congress, not camp. You can look at that. But basically, my point here is that music is all made up, right? And instruments are all inventions. So, you know, there are no rules. I'm going to take you through one of the many paths of music history and music hacking. And we're going to look at one piece of hacked technology and how people who played with it and did things with it that they weren't supposed to do changed modern music production. This is the magnetic tape recorder. It's a lovely device. It was popularized in World War II by the Nazis, who used it to chop up propaganda. After the World War, the BBC took it on themselves to try and develop a version of this. So this is relatively modern technology. So in the 40s and 50s, it started becoming popular, and it was used for reel-to-reel broadcasting. Right. So before this, it was gramophones. They were used in music studios, and they were relatively expensive. But as it became cheaper, a bunch of music hackers saw its potential to do something more than just line it up. So these hackers got their hands on a bunch of these magnetic tape recorders. As people are wont to do with technology that they get their hands on it, they started to fuck with it in new and very exciting ways. What they did is there was a movement in Paris in the early 1940s called Musique Concrète, which was the first group of people who were doing this, aside from one lonely guy in Egypt as well. But there was the epicenter of this is in Paris. And what you do is you see that the actual tape there, you use a razor blade to cut it. And then you can, for example, flip it over, tape it back together, and then you've got one piece that's backwards, right? Okay. And using that technique, I'll show you how, actually, here you go. This is... Okay, so not only can you chop things up and turn them around, you can speed them up and slow them down. This gives you, this seems, so basically if you do it faster, it will give you a higher tone, and if you do it slower, if you slow it down, it will be lower. Okay, we all know this kind of instinctually now, but back then this was completely revolutionary. You could make sounds that were not existing in nature. Take, for example, the plucking of a violin string, okay? You pluck a violin string, and it comes on quick. It's like, boom, and then if you let it die off, there's a long... So what we call that in music is it's a sharp attack and a long delay. And that's how a lot of musical instruments or natural sounds will work, okay? They will fade off, okay? But using this technology, you could switch it around, so it had the opposite effect, so it went, whoom, the long attack and a short delay. So you could create sounds that are not found in nature now, which is extraordinary. And at the same time, there was the advent of something called field recording, which was you could go outside. Instead of having to record in a studio, you could have a physical piece of equipment that you could carry around with you and a microphone. So you could go and record sounds outside. Found sound is what we call it. And then you could take it back to the studio, chop it up with a scalpel, sellotape it back together, re-record it, and you could create... This is just, you know, it's just a huge, vast new set of tools that you can work with as somebody who's making music. Now, the first people doing this were, as I say, these French guys in Paris, in music concrete, and they were doing it. And due to modern music, digital preservation techniques, you can hear the sounds that they were making on YouTube. You can spend some time and listen to that. I won't lie, they sound pretty awful. Nobody wants to listen to that. I mean, unless you're a true enthusiast. But it's not about the music they were making; it's about the techniques that they were creating. Their experimentation sounded terrible, but actually it was incredibly influential. We use sampling now as just an ordinary thing, but this was the technology behind it. It really came to a head in the 1960s when the Beatles were the first people to use this technique. On Tomorrow Never Knows. Now, normally, I would play this, but when I did a talk similar to this at the Hackaday Super Conference, they pulled my live stream because there was a 10-second snippet of the Beatles. So I've decided not to risk it today. But you can look up Tomorrow Never Knows, and you can hear these wong, wong, wong kind of sounds, and that's actually flipped. That's just flipped sounds. All of the Beatles brought in sounds from their home. They flipped it around, speeded it up, and slowed it down. There's a famous, very high-pitched sound in that song. And it's just Paul McCartney laughing, and they've manipulated it using sticky tape and scalpels. Anyway, so that was the beginning of these new production techniques, right? You can use these in modern music, in your Ableton or your Logic or whatever. You know, those are just standard features, but this was the beginning of it. And it's incredibly influential. I could follow it down this path, but I'm actually going to leave them to go on with their modern mainstream production, and I'm going to talk about this woman instead, who was... One of my favorite things about hacker culture is the way that we learn from each other and the way that we riff off of each other's work. So I'm going to go slightly sideways and talk about this artist and engineer. Her name is Daphne Oram. Who's heard of Daphne Oram? All right, about 10 of you. Which is more than usual, actually, to be honest. So Daphne Oram is, everyone should know her name, and that's why I never shut up about her. She was a musician and physicist and electronics engineer who was unfortunate enough to be a woman and has a pretty tragic work history. But she's one of the iconic figures of early electronic music. She should be as well known as, you know, any of the, as Moog or whatever. But anyway, so she's a trained musician, and she got a job at the BBC queuing up these reel-to-reel magnetic tape recorders, which is actually a pretty big deal at the time for a woman as well. She went on a training course to Paris, and just studio recording techniques, you know, standard corporate training, right? And she, while she was there, I believe she met some of the people behind the Musique Concrète, and she was, and it basically, they showed her what she, they were doing, and it totally blew her mind. She was like, oh my God, I'm going to take this back to the BBC, it's going to be so cool, I'm going to revolutionize everything, it's going to be awesome. She took it back there, and predictably enough, everyone was like, no, go back to pressing buttons. So she did, but she also would run around the BBC late at night after hours, stealing bits of equipment from other people's studios and wheeling them into her own studio, and she would experiment with all these Musique Concrète methods. There's Eve, she, as an electronics person as well, she was one of the first people in the world to make purely electronic music, because she was one of the first instances of someone who recorded her oscilloscope and then started using that for compositional purposes as well. And she was doing this for maybe 5, 6, 7 years, and at the end of that, she started to get some interest. She managed finally to convince somebody to give her a commission to create some incidental music for a piece of, for a show. And it was a success. Also, people hated it, of course. But enough people wanted her to repeat it that eventually the BBC gave her her own studio, which is like absolutely, you know, out of the question for someone in the 50s. For a woman in the 50s. So she was starting to make this, but she, unfortunately, at this point, it's called the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which is one of the most iconic sound design workshops and studios in the whole history of music technology. So she starts this workshop, the BBC Radiophonic Workshops, but a year later, she leaves to start her own artist practice, because they said, she said, they wanted my ideas and they wanted my work, but they didn't want me. So she had to leave her life's work, and she was largely erased, actually, from everything that she did, even though she founded this iconic, this absolutely iconic workshop. And she went off and created, she didn't have a sad life after that, but she went off and created this wild synthesizer, which is in the London Science Museum now. It was like, instead of, she loved looking at waveforms of music, so she thought she would use watercolor to draw the waveforms and then have a synthesizer interpret those waveforms, and that's called the Oramics machine. It's like absolutely wild. You can look that up on the internet as well. It's cool to look at. So yeah, she's becoming a bit more popular now because of the work of some of the guys at the Radiophonic Workshop who still exist, some of the old guys who go around telling cool stories about them, but also because of the woman she helped bring in who stayed after she left. And she's quite famous now because of something I'll show you. It's this lady, and this is Delia Derbyshire. Now, who's heard of Delia Derbyshire? A lot more of you, I thought so. Now, Delia Derbyshire, again, the same. She's got a maths and music degree. She couldn't get a job, but she ended up basically pestering them into letting her do some interning at the Radiophonic Workshop, and eventually got a job there. And then she was the arranger and made the instrumentation for this. Now, I'm going to play this for you. Before I do, I want you to think about the fact that at the time, every sound had to be physically cut and sticky taped together. Every single, not, and I'm not, and there's no multi-track recorders back then either. Okay, so you have to, it's an absolutely enormous process of recording the sound, stretching the sound, cutting the sound, sticking it back together, making it on a reel, recording that onto a separate reel, and then you've got this, and then you add more sounds, and then you have like several tapes that you have to condense into each other without multi-track technology, okay? They're literally at different machines shouting go at each other, and that's how they were charged multi-track. But she was very blasé about it. It was kind of amusing, because it seems ridiculous to me now to be able to compose a piece of music like that, like a jigsaw puzzle. But she just shrugged and said, well, it seemed to work, which I find kind of charming. But yes, yeah, so that's... Oh no, why didn't it play? Oh no! Oh, God damn it. Well, I'm gonna play it for you anyway. Oh, it's playing! Oh good, it just took a minute. Just tapes. your own instruments that you recorded, including my favorite, which is called the Wopulator, and that just fucking name. But yeah, so they actually used a lot of electronic engineering gear in their work. It's really cool. Anyway, we get paid as goes, and I don't want to get another copyright violation, so let's move on. I did actually want to play one of her own songs, so that's her commercial work, but she was also an electronic experimental musician of her own, on her own accord, and she, I think you kind of forget that music in the 50s and 60s actually kind of was wild as well. Let's see if we, this is one of her tracks from the 60s. It's kind of a banger. Does anyone recognize this track? Because someone did sample it. No? So Dee Antwoord literally just rapped over the top of this and released it as a track. She made this for a science fiction show that was based on an Asimov story, and this remains, but the Asimov story that it was made for has been deleted from the BBC archives, which I find to be an absolute tragedy. I would love to watch that. If you flip it back, the robotic sounds singing "Praise be to the master." So there we are. Thank you, Daphne. And so that's my story of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. But I wanted to leave you with a quote from one of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop engineers, unfortunately unnamed in the documentary that I watched. And I just thought this was kind of a cute sentiment. Because they were making things up. They weren't the experts in the room. They didn't know what they couldn't do. So they just basically managed to mess around with stuff and ended up with something really special and really cool and something that was just iconic. You know, some of the biggest electronic music acts in the world today still say that the work of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop was one of their big influences in life as well. So yeah, that's the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And I think it's really important that we allow for ridiculousness in technology, and we allow for ugly noises, and we allow for stupid things that don't fully, you don't really see what they're for. Like the power of allowing for experimentation that isn't very successful at first or doesn't sound successful to the outside ear is really important. Yeah, so outsiders, hooray. That was a golden age. We've got the invention of a new technology, or I should say the democratization, you know, the availability of a new technology to a reasonable number of people led to this amazing sea change in the way that people made music, made digital music, and well, analog back then, but you know, the way that we make music was changed by these experimenters. It was definitely a golden age for new techniques. But I think that we're currently in a golden age for people who are working with experimental instruments and experimental sound in general. And I think that we've got loads and loads of really exciting new technologies that are available. We've got cheap microcontrollers, we can make our own PCBs, we can make our own synthesizers, we can access people, which is really crucial. I mean, think about Daphne. She didn't learn about music concrete, and she didn't find the BBC Radiophonic Workshop until she had a spark of an idea from somebody else. So really, it's learning tools, learning gaining access to tools, learning new techniques, and learning and being inspired by other people is really, really critical for anything to really change and to happen. But I think that at the moment, we've got really, really cool, accessible new technology that more and more people are learning how to use, and more are becoming much simpler as well. Crucially, people are more accessible. So people share, particularly in our community, people share their knowledge very freely, and you don't have to be in the same room to do this. I know a bunch of people are listening on the live stream right now, so you don't have to be here to learn about things. And you don't have to be in the room to learn attend a workshop with somebody, right? There's these wonderful YouTube tutorials now for sharing information. Niche communities are just way more accessible through online places. We've got incredible community and events as well. So this is, I mean, I shouldn't have put this slide in here, but it doesn't matter. So this is one of my old hacker spaces. It's Machines Room in London. And it was where the music technology, one of the places where the music tech community in London was centered. They did it was there around the London Hackspace, but we did a lot of things. There's a community called Hackoustic that I was involved with, and we used to do a lot of events there. I'm saying that the reason I put this slide in was just to show that hackerspaces and makerspaces often have some kind of music technology partnerships. And those kind of central spaces where you can share things, share knowledge and get inspired by each other's work and also hold events is really, really crucial. Actually, I do know why I put this slide in. So this was a wonderful space for 3 years, and then the landlord raised the rent 4 times, and this amazing community of artists and designers and music hackers was removed, and at the same time, the London Hackspace moved from central London to West London, and a bunch of other hacker spaces and fab labs closed as well, just because of how expensive the center of London had become. As a direct result of that, I moved to Berlin. So, like, there's this by allowing this kind of gentrification of our hacker spaces, we actually do destroy community as much as we can create community online as well, like this. So this is. This is an example of awesome online community. This is a YouTube video from someone from the London music tech hacker scene, probably the most famous person from it, and this guy called Sam, who goes by Look Mum No Computer on the internet. And he's an electronic engineer and general purpose weirdo, which is why I like him. And this is one of his creations. He made a Furby synth, which is as horrific as you imagine, if not more so. So don't look that up. I mean, do look that up, but it's genuinely, be prepared to not have a nice time. But he doesn't just show his instruments. He doesn't just perform with them. He does really awesome electronics teardowns as well. So I've learned a bunch of stuff from watching his videos and looking at actually how he's done them. And that's something that's really exciting. I mean, like, maybe 20 years ago, I wouldn't have had access to this kind of knowledge. I just would have, you know, I probably wouldn't have even known that I like this kind of stuff. You know, I wouldn't have been exposed to it, and then I certainly would have, you know, I'd been going down my local pub saying, hey, who wants to work on a weird Furby instrument with me? And they'd be like, what? No. Like, so it's kind of nice to be able to share your weird passions with other people on the internet. And then, of course, we're at one of these. This is me and my friend Phoenix. We've done a fair bit of music tech hacking together, and this is actually the British version of Congress, EMF Camp. I guess it's the version of Chaos Camp, actually. But so EMF Camp, which is actually in 2020 this year. It's a really cool small hacker festival. But these kind of spaces and these kind of events really allow. I mean, I've learned so much just by being here the last couple of days, and every time we do these. So we should cherish. We should cherish the hackerspaces and the events, and we should also support people like Sam, who makes his living through Patreon and YouTube. You know, so it's by supporting makerspaces and events, and also by supporting individual people who are putting the effort in to create and share work, I think we can cherish this community. Okay, on to the final bit. So I'm going to show you some of the cool projects that I've been working on with other people. But the reason I've chosen the ones that I'm showing you is because they're also using some of my favorite ways that you can hack on instruments. So I figured I'd show you a project, but also show you how to make, you know, how you can have a go at it. So recently I've lived in London and Berlin, and one of my favorite things to do is when I'm in a space is to make an instrument in the context of two people's work, two or more people's work. Like, I always find, like, my work is always way better if I'm collaborating with somebody else. So, you know, what they do and what I do are smushed together to create something that's better than either of us could have done on our own. And I think this is a good example, if it will play. This is one of my first sonic circuit sculpture creatures. This started off as a hack, just overnight hack, with my composer friend, Andrew Hockey, and Drew Festini from Osh Park. myself, obviously, and we worked together overnight to create this. This is a circuit sculpture. If you don't know what circuit sculpture is, it's basically instead of putting your circuit inside of a box, all of the parts or the key parts of it are shown and are actually celebrated as art in their own right. And so that's what circuit sculpture is. And there's a couple of wonderful people. There's this guy called Mohit, who makes really beautiful things, who's living in San Francisco. And then there's a guy called Jiri, who is in Prague, I want to say. And they make really, really awesome, tiny, neat things. But I'm not tiny and neat, so I make big, massive, messy things. So this is the first one I made. It was really interesting to me. I really like capacitive touch as a technology. It's can be unreliable, but I find it kind of really fun to work with. And it's very intuitive for a musician. And then that led to me developing a second creature. I'm really inspired by kind of utopian science fiction, and I wanted to make a series of creatures that inhabited the same world and sung when you touched them. So this was the second in the series. This is a more traditional instrument. I mean, obviously, it's still weird. But it's more traditional in that the first one was generative. In some way, like semi-generative. And this one is more like one note per limb with two modes of modulation. This is a bass. Wob, wob, wob. So that's my bass creature, which I'm actually developing for a real musician now. And this woman, amazing bassist called Isay Hassan, who is the bassist for the Savages and just was on tour with the Pixies. And I'm making her a stage presence one, so she's going to be able to play it. But that's going to be more generation-based as well. But it's kind of interesting to try and create something that, in its functionality, is very traditional, but in its form is really weird, and that was kind of fun to play with. But now my latest one is another creature, but this is kind of like an abstract cephalopod. It's going to be human-sized, and each of the limbs will play a different part of the choral arrangement. And then there's like some kind of like sunlight feature at the top where you can modulate it by touching the copper rods. I've actually made a prototype which you can listen to. So this is the latest version of one of the limbs of the tentacle, which I made. I just made it for the form, but then everybody seems to really like cuddling it. It's very comforting, so I decided to make it purr after I'd finished prototyping it. So if you want to listen to my purring tentacle afterwards, you can. It does sometimes work. But I should say, actually, hello. So this is machine embroidered conductive thread. So that is able then to detect capacitive. That's a capacitive touch sensor, essentially. It's a sensicle. So yeah, you can listen to that afterwards if you want. It mostly works. I made it yesterday, so yeah, that's that. That's quite fun. But again, you know, I would not have been able to create the intricate sounds without the help of my composer friend, and I would not have been able, you know, there's, and I would not have been able to get the implementation that I wanted onto the BeagleBoard without Drew. So it's really nice to kind of like sit together and mash up your skills. Now these all use one of these. And this is another one of my instruments. This is a wearable, flexible PCB. It's going to be a vocoder, but it's not finished yet. But the reason I'm showing you that is because that's the sensor that I use. This is a, they call it the trill. It's essentially like, if any of you have used capacitive touch before, you've probably used an MPR121 sensor. This is like an MPR121 sensor +++. It's much more, it's got like, I think 20 something pins, which is wild. And it's way more sensitive as well. So I find it really, really great. So if anybody's doing stuff with CapTouch and they're having some problems with it, A, make sure you're grounded, and B, have a go on that trill. It's like 10 euros, I think, that sensor. And it's done by Bella. You can see one of their boards there. Now I'm going to do a whole slide about Bella and fangirl about them, because they're my favorite technology at the moment to use for embedded systems for embedded instruments. This is like the size. This is this big. It's based on the Pocket Beagle, which is the size of a small Altoids tin. So it's very, very small. But it runs. It runs. It's a full Linux computer, and the it's really, really awesome. Super, super responsive. Super low latency, which is really important when you're creating instruments. But also the cool thing is it runs this. This is pure data. It's a visual programming language for sound creation. Now a lot of artists and sound designers and music creators, they use this already. You might. This is very similar to something called Max, actually made by the same guy, but this one's open source. So that's Bella and Pure Data. Definitely worth checking out if you're interested in instrument design. The reason the Bella is special is because of the low latency, but also because no other. So you can't get a microcontroller that will run Pure Data, except for, so the Raspberry Pi does, but the latency on the Raspberry Pi is like me. So I would always suggest, if you're doing something, the Bella and Pure Data is a nice combo. Okay, that's that one. Then the other project I wanted to talk to you briefly about is Ariana Grande, who you probably don't know who she is, but anyone under the age of 13 certainly will. And here she is demoing something called a Mimu glove. It's a gesture control. It's gesture control. She's controlling. She's doing looping. She's doing effects. Using obviously gestures, various gestures. Thank you, Ariana. So that's the. This is what she's using here, and this is coming out of London, but of the music tech company called Mimu, that was originated by Imogen Heap, if you know her. And I saw that Ariana video, and something I didn't mention is I actually do quite a lot of teaching as well. When I saw that Ariana video, I just thought, I was like, oh my God, if I showed this to a 12-year-old girl and told them we could make one, they were going to lose their mind. So these cost like $5,000, though, so I don't think I could get one for use in the classroom. So I just messaged Imogen and asked her if I could make a children's version. So I did. She said yes, and this is a wonderful piece of technology called the Microbit, and it's a DIY. It's like my first microcontroller that is made by the BBC. It's like £10. It's very, very cheap. It doesn't do a lot, but what it does very well and very simply. I was able to make an approximation of a $5,000 glove with a $10. Microcontroller, which is nice. That's what the core of the product that I made is actually in. I haven't got time to talk to you about that. That's my leather robot unicorn, like gesture control. But I can't tell you about that. This is another artist, got no time for that. So we're going on to this last one. So basically, I was able to, with one bridge, one microbit, and a little bit of code, get it to work on professional music software. And this is a musician called Bishy, who's really awesome. And this is her using my $10 hack to do a very similar thing to a $5,000. And of course, that's not stadium level. Ariana Grande couldn't use that on tour. It was a fun project that we hacked together. That's my time. I have done all of the, by the way, all of this, how I did that, that's all on my GitHub, all of the code. If you've already got on Microbit, you can do it yourself. Or you can get the kit, it's like $30, it's not very expensive. So all that's on my GitHub, along with some weird factory sounds of things. And you can follow along on my weird electronic adventures on my Twitter. I'm pretty reactive, so say hi to me. And I'll be hanging around here if you want to listen to my tentacle. So, the end. Okay.
Ellen Lee, whoa. Thank you, Helen, for this fantastic presentation. I'm wondering, actually, how are we going to play that thing there with the slime? Are there questions here? No? Yes, online, of course. They're far much more speedy than we... Shoot.
So the question from the internet is, have you ever considered creating music without human interaction?
Yes.
Okay, then next one.
Thank you, good night. no, I mean, I'm a very tactile person, so I like creating instruments that that you stroke, that are affectionate almost, and kind. I like giving the things that I create some kind of persona and that you interact with them. However, a lot of people there's a lot of people doing really interesting things with generative, non-human interactive art. In fact, the composer friend that I was talking about, Andrew Hockey, he's hacked a musical marble run that is just automated. When the marbles go down the marble run, it will trigger generative sounds, which is really, really cool. There's lots of people doing it, but for me personally, I just, I like touching the objects that I make, you know? I'm the kind of strange person who walks around a craft store with a multimeter, kind of like touching things and like figuring it if they're conductive, like adequately conductive.
You're measuring how it...
Yeah, so like, so for example, in fabric stores, there might be something that's conductive that's not actually billed as conductive. Or I'll often go to art stores and craft stores or architectural supply stores. And you can find, you don't have to go to Conrad, you can go to Modular. With your multimeter. In fact, it's either conductive or it's not, right? You know?
We believe you. I'm just imagining you there.
Oh yeah, no, it's yeah.
On the flea market.
I've had some strange looks.
A question here from number two, please, here in the front.
Have you also created instruments that actually work with the physicality of the object that you have built instead of triggering sound processing?
You mean in what
like
way?
If the tentacle itself, the sound it produces would be amplified and somehow that
is
the base
more
of the,
acoustic,
of the processing of the actual...
Yes,
that comes out.
Actually, when the tentacle is done, it will have some kind of physical feedback loop in it that will be reactive to its its space, to its personal space even as well. So actually, the cool thing about capacitive touch technology is if you get the thresholding right, you can not just sense touch, you can sense proximity. Mm-hmm. And that kind of also varies on how many people are in the room as well, so you can get it to react quite... Well, not like uniformly, but you can get it to react quite nicely to its environment and also the way that people are manipulating it as well. And you can also code some cool things into that as well. So basically, based on the number of touches, how often people have played with it, and how people have played with that, get that to feed back in to the music that it's making in a generative fashion. There's lots of cool things that I want to do with this next sculpture.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm
so sad. I have a spoiler here. We have to shut this now. And I would like you to ask to talk to her personally here, next to the stage. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Helen Lee, for this fantastic presentation.